A whole slew of new Iowa laws went into effect at the start of this month. This hour, we'll survey how some of these laws may affect you. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The AP's Barbara Rodriguez and IPR's Joyce Russell will join us a little later to talk about the new Iowa laws that may have an impact on your life, including those concerning so-called sanctuary cities, mental health care, school security, and so-called school lunch shaming, also driving under the influence, among many other new laws. Before that, a conversation with Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein. She's only been ISU president just over half a year. That's all coming up. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A little bit later in the hour, Joyce Russell, IPR's Joyce Russell, and Barbara Rodriguez of the Associated Press will join us. Talk about a whole slew of laws that went into effect here in Iowa as of July 1st. But before that, we have the pleasure of talking with Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein. She is ISU's 16th president, the first woman to hold the job in Iowa State's 159-year history, has been in office since last November, and so marking about a half year, one semester in that office. She spent nearly four decades working at Iowa State University before becoming president, dean of ISU's College of Agriculture and Life Sciences in our Ames studio. President Winterstein, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be here with you. I appreciate the opportunity for the conversation.
We want to reach out to our listeners this half hour. If you have a question for President Winterstein, please join us. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Earlier today, I had finances at the top of my list, President Winterstein, but I would like to have you react to this breaking news at the front page of the New York Times website as of this moment. I'll just read some from the New York Times article. It's about the headline, Trump Administration Reverses Obama on Affirmative Action. The Trump administration will encourage the nation's school superintendents and college presidents to adopt race-blind admission standards, abandoning an Obama administration policy that called on universities to consider race as a factor in diversifying their campuses. These are multiple news outlets reporting this from unnamed officials. So today what happened, the Justice Department rescinding seven policy guidelines from the Education Department's Civil Rights Division. The breaking news today. President Winterstein, how do you think this will change admissions at Iowa State University?
Well, what I know about being a great land-grant university is that we believe in accessibility. And if you are a student that meets our minimal admission standards, then we welcome you at Iowa State. We also believe at Iowa State in the strength of diversity. We have a very strong, diverse population at Iowa State. About 24% of our students are multicultural or international, and they bring a great wealth of knowledge and opportunity for all of our students. I always say that when you have the ability to interact with a student from India and learn about their lives, become friends with them, that it gives you a different set of understanding about the world and also a different set of opportunities.
Is the ISU admission policy, though, to use the term used by George W. Bush's administration, is it race neutral in the way you admit students? Is it race blind, race neutral?
Yes, I believe it is. We certainly have scholarships that individual donors have provided to us, and those scholarships are very specific about the individuals that would be eligible for a scholarship. So we have all sorts of possibilities and opportunities for students to come. to be supported in a variety of different ways at Iowa State.
Mm-hmm. Now, Iowa State University, I understand, is part of an alliance of universities that targets the student retention and graduation disparity that that exists between white and non-white students. I see the data from 2016 showing there's a 15% gap between these students graduating. How are you addressing that? Or talk a little bit about the problem that you and this alliance of other alliance of universities are addressing.
Well, we've been so pleased to be a part of the University Innovation Alliance now since 2014. Really an opportunity for us to address this achievement gap, as we call it, for our poor students, our multicultural students, our first-generation students coming to Iowa State University. This alliance allows the participating universities, there are 11 of us, to exchange the best practices that we've developed that have made a difference. And this exchange of ideas and practices has truly been for the benefit of all of our students. And in fact, I'll tell you that now the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities has 100 universities that now are stepping up saying that they want to do something similar to what we've done with the University Innovation Alliance. So it's a trend that is catching on, which will be for the benefit of all students across the nation.
Let's talk about tuition. I had some tuition increases announced at the last Board of Regents meeting back in June. One member of the Board of Regents describing what was happening as the worst state government attack on our three public universities that I can ever remember. You've been at ISU for several decades. In that meeting, the Board of Regents unanimously approved tuition increases in response to the legislative cuts in the general education appropriations. So now, what does the financial picture look like? And I realize you did get a little bit of a bump there to budget in for the new year, but you've had to deal with big cutbacks, haven't you?
Well, certainly the legislative agenda was a mixed bag for Iowa State University. We had to accommodate $5.4 million in permanent reduction to our budget, but then received an additional $3.15 million in funds to our budget for undergraduate student financial aid. In addition, we received about $63.5 million to support the new veterinary diagnostic lab. So again, kind of a mixed picture in terms of support from the state.
Mm-hmm. How have you absorbed the consecutive rounds of mid-year cuts? I don't know. What is the number that ISU had to absorb, and how did you do it?
Well, again, it's that $5.4 million reduction that was made permanent for the current year budget. We went through a process with our deans, our vice presidents and senior vice presidents, with our faculty senate and our professional and scientific council, and really a set of planning exercises that interim president Ben Allen began when he was still with us a year ago. Those planning exercises helped us understand really what was possible and what we could do. So we were able to identify significant one-time money from positions that had been unable to be filled, resources from different units on campus that could be applied to that one-time money, and did a pretty good job of protecting the core missions at Iowa State from the impact of that mid-year reversion. Of course, that was not as true as we went through the process to implement that reduction permanently.
Mm-hmm. Faculty resignations have been in the news concerning ISU, hitting a 10-year high. This is July 17 through June 18. Your university seeing its highest faculty resignation in a decade, 44 resigning. Many were tenured or tenure track. How concerned are you about this spike in faculty resignations?
Well, I'm very concerned. When we think about what we do at Iowa State, we do it with great people in our faculty and staff ranks. And when you lose that level of faculty in a given year, you start to understand that when you're not able to give a faculty and staff salary increase like we were not able to do last year, that these individuals have the ability to go and get a better job at another university. There are always greener pastures out there. And if we can't compete in the market, then we will lose the best people. This year, we were able to do a 1% increase in salary on average for our faculty and staff. But that would be low in comparison to many of the competitors out and about in these other universities. So again, for Iowa to have excellent universities in the state, to maintain the excellence of Iowa State University, we have to have the resources to pay our faculty and staff an appropriate salary and provide the appropriate benefits.
Of these 44 faculty that resigned at ISU in that last fiscal year, how many said it was because of that pay, the pay freeze last year, that they left?
Well, it's kind of a mixed response. 44% said that their new position would pay much higher. And so I think that's an indicator that certainly salary in all of our minds play a significant role in the positions that we decide to take on in our careers.
Mm-hmm. The University of Iowa, I know, has a wage freeze this coming fiscal year. Why not have another wage freeze? Was it precisely because of these resignations?
It certainly is about keeping our best faculty and staff at Iowa State University. Again, we had a salary freeze last year, and the University of Iowa didn't do that last year. So we may not be on the same schedule, but we were both faced with a serious issue when it comes to how we provide competitive salaries to our faculty and staff. And at this point, when you look at our peers, and it is, again, about a market, when we look at our peer universities, we're down at the bottom now in terms of how we compensate our faculty.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein is my guest. ISU's 16th president has been in office since last November. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. Now, at this regents meeting in June, this question of how to deal with tuition rises came up, and ISU facing the question that the other public universities have faced: should some majors pay more for tuition than others? The regents have supported different tuition models, charging students more for enrolling in some costlier programs. And I understand ISU has been given the go-ahead to expand its what's called a differential tuition program. What's happening on that front?
So, in fact, the Board of Regents did approve differential tuition. So when you look at Iowa State University now, about 52% of our programs now charge differential tuition for the junior and senior years. And this is based on the increased cost that occurs in those two final years as you're in smaller classes, you have more laboratories, more experiential learning. And so this gives us an opportunity to be able to maintain the quality for those students in those majors. We had lots of conversations on campus with our students across the university before we proceeded with this request to the Board of Regents. One of my favorite memories is hearing from a young man, a math major, who came up to me and said he originally had been opposed to this. But after he talked and learned about what the salaries for his professors were, it became clear to him that we needed to be able to retain faculty and to give them appropriate salary increases. And he became in favor of the differential tuition because he wanted to be able to maintain quality in the faculty that teach him and in the experience in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Just how different can these differential tuitions be? What is a range of, from what would be a lower tuition, the lowest tuition perhaps per credit hour at ISU compared to, you know, one of these classes at the end of your your learning experience that is more expensive?
Certainly. So the base tuition is $7,740. Again, significantly lower than our peer universities and most of the universities in the geographic area in which Iowa resides. For the different majors in the sciences, you'd be looking at an increase, the differential tuition of $1,600. If you're in the engineering college, then you'd be looking at an increase of $2,612.
Mm-hmm. Now, Governor Kim Reynolds in the past has expressed concern about about these differential tuition programs, that it may push people away from certain vocations. Do you share that concern, or are we not at that point with this sort of differential?
As we visited with our students, we did not get that feedback, that they would make a change in their major based upon the tuition. So we're going to continue to get feedback from our students, hear what they have to say. But I really don't believe that a student who chooses to become a mechanical engineer is going to change their mind based upon the differential tuition charge.
Let me stay on finances for one final point. You were given a five-year contract when you came into office last November. First year annual salary of $525,000, increasing to $550,000. Your second year, $590,000. Your third year, plus some deferred compensation contingent on the completion of your contract. I wonder, in light of the fiscal situation, have you thought about or would you support any sort of sacrifice, bypassing a salary increase, any sort of gesture in that direction at a challenging fiscal moment for all of the public universities?
Well, when we announced the salary policy, I believe I stated that, or when we announced the news about the last Board of Regents meeting, I shared that I would be providing my my salary increase to the ISU Foundation.
Okay. Bruce is joining us from Iowa City, 1-866-780-9100. I have just a few minutes left with ISU President Wendy Winterstein. Bruce, not much time. What do you got for us? Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. I was wondering if, in light of these drastic cuts by the state to the public universities, whether or not roles are increasingly being filled by adjunct professors who are paid much less and oftentimes have workloads that are much higher. So that's my question.
Bruce, thank you. In Iowa City.
So at Iowa State University, we have lecturers who are non-tenure track, whose sole responsibility is teaching. For Iowa State University, we have seen an increase in the number of lecturers as we've seen our enrollment go up since 2009 by 35%. So that the number of lecturers, the percentage of lecturers has gone up. I think it's been for us a good mix. We work very hard at Iowa State to value our lecturers, to recognize the contributions they provide. And right now at Iowa State University, I feel that our tenure track faculty and our lecturers have a very collaborative and good partnership.
Let me talk, connect this university, your university, with what's happening on the national front. The Trump administration, of course, carrying out more aggressive immigration policies. How are those policies impacting student life at ISU?
Well, certainly we care deeply about all of our students. And just recently, as we have heard about the decision from the Supreme Court, we have reached out to our students who are here studying to make sure that they are given all the appropriate information and that we are supporting them in this difficult time.
The Supreme Court decision, you mean the third version of the president's travel ban?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And you have students, I don't know if you have numbers there, from these seven countries?
So we have students from some of those countries, and we know who those students are. And again, we have reached out to them individually, asked them to work with our International Student Services office so that we can help them and help them understand what this means to them. Earlier in the program, Ben, I said that we value diversity. It's important for our students to have the opportunity to work with students from all over the world. We have students from 127 countries. And so we want to see the value in those interactions and the friendships and what happens as we prepare students to be great contributors to society, whether they're here in Iowa or they're around the world.
Mm-hmm. Free speech on campus, hate speech in the country has been on the rise. We have of course, a polarized society. Has that crossed your desk? Have you been dealing with free speech controversies on campus? Have you had new rules when you look about what's going on in the rest of the country, perhaps other campuses?
Well, free speech, of course, is one of the basic tenets of our country, and we uphold that. And in fact, had a very great lecture on campus earlier this year from the chancellor of UC Irvine, going through free speech and what it means on a university campus. So it's something we certainly are talking about, but it's not something that we've experienced in a negative way that you've seen on some of the other campuses around the nation.
In May of this year, an Iowa State University survey found that more than 200 students and staff have been raped or molested on the Ames campus. Talk about remedies to this problem. How are you addressing it?
Well, sexual assault is a serious issue on campuses around the nation. And so last fall, the students came forward and asked if we would begin a new program called Green Dot. And it's really a program focused on power-based violence. And it gives training to our students and our faculty and staff to help them understand if they see something terrible happening, how can they intervene or how do they call for help? Our police officers, Chief of Police Newton, has been very engaged with this program. All of our police vehicles now have big green dots either on the back or side windows to call attention to this program. So we are very, very serious about how we address this issue. We also have a series of training programs for all faculty and staff and students in this area. And finally, I'd mention that alcohol is really an important issue to be considered, alcohol abuse. And oftentimes, the situations that some of our students get involved in end up being tied to alcohol. Mm-hmm. So we're also working hard to help our students better understand how they can, if they're how they can drink legally and responsibly. So it's a complex issue, but we're working hard to address all the various aspects of this issue.
In the approximately minute we have left, President Winterstein, a question for you from Leslie in Des Moines asking, can you address how other administrators and coaches at ISU are paid and how that's determined in relation to faculty salaries?
Well, athletics is an important part of the college experience, and our student athletes bring a lot of opportunity to everyone to enjoy and engage in athletics. When we think about coaches and their salaries, again, you have to think back to what the market is. And I think that's how we think about salaries for our faculty and staff. And so I think that's where we are with salaries for our coaches as well.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, before we say goodbye, you've been in office just over half a year. You've been at ISU a long time, but would you say you've achieved the learning curve, or are you still on the learning curve as president?
When I was named president, I said I was going to go out and listen around Iowa State University and around Iowa, and I've been doing a lot of that. I have to tell you, I learn every day, and I'm going to keep learning every day as I continue on in my presidency.
Iowa State University President Wendy Winterstein, the first woman to hold that job in Iowa State's 159-year history. President Winterstein, thank you very much for coming into the studio today.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we'll find out about a lot of laws, and I bet you there are many you haven't heard of or weren't aware of, new laws that went into effect July 1st, talking with the AP's Barbara Rodriguez and our own Joyce Russell. That's when we return. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's be frank, the name of that special program in place of Charity Nebbe's Talk of Iowa tomorrow at 10. In place of this program, tomorrow, Independence Day, Capital Steps, Politics Takes a Holiday over the noon hour tomorrow, Wednesday, on the 4th of July. Well, a whole slew of new laws went into effect July 1st. Let's discuss as many of them as we can get to with our own Joyce Russell, IPR legislative correspondent in our Ames studio. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
In our Des Moines studio, Barbara Rodriguez, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press in Iowa. Barbara, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And if our listeners have any questions about new laws, 1-866-780-9100 or river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let me start with you, Barbara, and have you address the sanctuary cities ban. A lot of this in the news, addressing cities, counties, municipalities that intentionally violate federal immigration law. So what is the new law here?
So it's basically aimed at local entities and, you know, city, county, law enforcement. It's aimed at ensuring that they follow immigration law, and if they don't, they risk losing funding. It's basically focused on the scenario where federal immigration could come in to law enforcement and ask them to hold an individual who is suspected of being in the country illegally. And that's at the heart of the legislation.
Mm-hmm. I know in discussions about this during the legislative session, there was controversy and talking with local authorities, sort of the idea that some local authorities maintain there wasn't even a problem here, that the same cooperation has always existed, that will continue to exist.
Right. And they argued that it would potentially hinder their ability to work with immigrant communities, that it would possibly raise concerns about trust. And there has been questions about its legality because, you know, the question is, how long can you hold an individual who there's no means for holding them. There's the possibility that you could violate their constitutional rights. And so there are immigration attorneys and groups that oppose the legislation that pointed out that the state could find itself in some issues over litigation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about mental health care. Joyce, mental health services expanding in Iowa. What are the facets of this new mental health care law?
Well, you know, we're not going to see this any kind of dramatic change right away, but this is a very detailed plan for, really, it's essentially what an effective mental health care system would look like once it is in effect. It expands services to take the strain off of law enforcement, sometimes emergency rooms that deal with mental health crises. There was a very strong mental health care lobby that followed this bill. And even though it goes into effect July 1st, they call it a start. Mm-hmm. There's a separate task force that will be working on funding options. And then at the same time, there's a new initiative that's been launched to come up with a companion plan for childhood mental illness, which the statewide system that's already in place for adults doesn't cover. And the governor just appointed that group today.
Mm-hmm. So how bipartisan was this? Was this something that most legislators could get on board, regardless of party?
It was extremely bipartisan, and in fact, there had been a task force that came up with these recommendations, and it was a broad group of stakeholders, police, healthcare professionals, families, everybody that's been touched by mental illness and by weaknesses in the mental health system. They came up with this comprehensive plan, and actually the bill that was passed with a few additions was really just taking their plan, putting it into law, and passing it and sending it to the governor.
Part of it are these six regional, what are called access centers. Now, did they appear July 1st, or is that something we'll see gradually here? And is there a timeline? Do you know?
I don't know. There's no deadline for it. And as I said, funding is an issue. But in Johnson County, in your county there, for example, they have plans. You know, they're devising plans for this. And they presented those to the legislature when they were considering this legislation on how that would work. It's hard to say when that will actually happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Barbara, keeping in the health sphere, health insurance, a new law that has to do with health insurance? What's that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's aimed at that population that may have been priced out of health insurance under the individual insurance market of the Affordable Care Act. And so this was an attempt by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and Republicans. They pushed it strongly this session, legislation to allow the Iowa Farm Bureau to create these health care plans to address that population. It's interesting because they're not calling it insurance, even though I've spoken to a lot of people in the health insurance industry who say it is insurance, but the distinction allows it to not be as regulated by the state. And the idea with those plans, though, is that they may not have to comply with all of the rules of the Affordable Care Act, essential benefits that might be covered under the individual insurance market. And it's going to come down to specifics. So this is in place now. They won't really be available until 2019. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of information yet as to what's actually covered. If you have a pre-existing condition, are you going to get the same kind of benefits that you might expect otherwise? So there's a lot of questions still out there, but expect Reynolds and Republicans to really highlight that as their way of addressing the skyrocketing cost of health insurance.
Right. And the interesting point that some will not want to call it insurance. So I guess here, buyer beware, you pay what you get for, you get what you pay for in these health care plans, that it may be minimal in terms of what kind of coverage you have.
Exactly. And at the moment, the public doesn't have a lot of information yet as to what happens when you get sick and you're in this plan. And so while, again, it's being advertised as a big win for the state addressing that cost, does that mean that we have taken a step back in terms mm-hmm. of coverage for individuals? And are we going back to a world where pre-existing conditions really limits your ability to be covered? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of questions still mm-hmm. out there.
Right.
I would like to add that, you know, it tended to be Democrats who would argue, you know, sort of for Obamacare, for the Affordable Care Act and those kinds of protections. But when it got right down to the final vote, there were a lot of Democrats who voted for this bill because everybody, rural, urban, everybody has people in their district who are struggling to pay for health insurance.
And that's a really good point.
Mm. Barbara Rodriguez with us of the AP, Joyce Russell, our own legislative correspondent at Iowa Public Radio, flying over quickly at a glance as some of Iowa's new laws that went into effect July 1st. If you have a question, 1-866-780-9100. A new state law having to do with alcohol and driving, Joyce. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, this is the ignition interlock bill that we've talked a little bit about on this program, but it currently, if you have a drunk driving conviction, arrest and conviction, your license is automatically suspended for 6 months. However, there is something called a temporary license that you can get, and currently that is just a license just to go to and from work. And currently, if you have had more than one drunk driving offense, or if you have a really bad drunk driving offense, in other words, way over the legal limit, then you're required to have this interlock ignition device that you breathe into it, and if you've been drinking, then you can't start your car. Well, what this bill does is extend that to more drivers, so that even if you've had just a first offense drunk driving, if you want to get a temporary restricted license, then you have to put one of these on your car, even if it's a first offense. But at the same time, the other change that's part of this, which is kind of interesting, is, as I said, currently you can only get this temporary license in order to drive only to work and back. This bill will allow you to drive anywhere. So it opens that up. And what the public safety people say is that the way it is now, or the way it was in the old law, the temporary license was so restrictive that some drivers would just drive with their suspended license, not get the restricted license, and just take the risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they have to drive their kids to school or all kinds of, you know how we can all imagine how hard it is to drive, you know, to be without a license. So
all right.
Now there will be an incentive to get that restricted license because it's going to be more useful. It will essentially be a new driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be this added safety of everyone having to get the ignition interlock. So I just consider this kind of a different approach to controlling drunk driving.
Mm-hmm. Jeff in Iowa City has an email on pertaining to this law. I don't know if it's too detailed to have either of you answer. Will the new law pertaining to interlock devices for DUI first offenses pertain to just those with offenses after July 1st, or would people with previous offenses still have to obtain an interlock device? Jeff shares, I had a first offense DUI 2 years ago, but have not yet reinstated my license, and I'm wondering if this will be required for me.
Well, I'm going to hazard a guess on this.
Okay.
And obviously, call the DOT and they can tell you. But, you know, if it's been 2 years since his drunk driving offense, then his 6-month suspension would be over. And he should be able to just get his actual permanent license renewed now, no temporary license. And I'm assuming no requirements for the interlock because your suspension is over.
Right.
So the interlock device requirement is for drivers who get this temporary restricted license while their actual license is suspended. But that's just my best guess, and I would advise the listener to call the DOT.
Call the DOT. Get in touch with perhaps a probation officer, someone in that order to make sure you've got it down straight. Also concerning alcohol, a new law that limits lawsuits, sort of going in the other direction, limiting lawsuits against Iowa businesses serving alcoholic beverages to drunken drivers. Barbara, do you know about this?
Just a little bit. It essentially is going to cap some damages awarded in cases where businesses are selling alcohol to an individual who then ends up getting involved in later in some type of crash that involves an injury or death or some other, again, serious injury. At the time during the legislative session, I know my understanding is that a lot of businesses argued that the liability that came with the insurance for that was too high compared to some other states. And so there was a big push from the business industry to get this legislation through.
Let's go to a caller. Karen is with us in Grimes. What's your question, Karen, about our new laws?
Well, it's about an old law that was passed in 2013, the corporate tax cut. Is the legislature and the government going to backfill that for our county governments because they're going to be running low on property taxes to help our schools and our hospitals and so forth?
Mm. Karen and Grimes, thanks. Joyce, Barbara, any comment on that?
I just want to note, this is Barbara, that it was a topic that was discussed extensively during the session, whether it was time to start reducing that backfill, with the argument being that the intention was never to have it that backfill continue forever. And so at the end, they didn't agree on anything, but I would expect much more clear-cut legislation earlier next session that gives a much clearer timetable as to reducing the backfill. There were a couple of proposals that were floating around by the end of the session.
And Governor Reynolds, the main reason she gave for not going back on this promise of a backfill was that cities and counties and schools already had their budgets written and they wouldn't want to pull that out from under them. But so the implication there, you can kind of read between the lines and say they're warned now. And I agree with Barbara. I think it's very likely that they'll take some action on that next year.
Less than 10 minutes of this flyover of new Iowa laws here. I have about a dozen things left on my list. We obviously aren't going to get to those, so I'm just going to reach out to each of you, pick out some of the ones you want to talk about here. I'll have a few questions. Barbara, what's something we haven't talked about that you think our listeners should know about?
There was something I reported on recently about a self-promotion ban. It recently went into effect. It was kind of interesting. It was kind of tucked into an unrelated budget bill in the final hours of the legislative session. It basically bans the use of taxpayer dollars for statewide elected officials and state lawmakers to essentially promote their written name or their likeness or their voice. There's an exemption that, you know, would clearly address much more run-of-the-mill communication between the official and a constituent. But the language is broad enough, and this Iowa Ethics Board now has to come up with its interpretation of the law. So it's really interesting. They haven't come out with an advisory opinion yet, but they're expected to in the next couple of weeks. And it's going to potentially address everything from, can, you know, does your likeness include appearing at the Iowa State Fair, for example? Mm-hmm. If you've purchased materials from years ago, does that fall under this ban now? And there's just all of these questions that they have to kind of grapple with, this ethics board. So I think that's kind of interesting, in part because there's not that many states that have kind of stepped onto this territory.
Right. Hard to draw a line. What is self-promotion? What is informing your constituents?
Exactly.
Where is that line? Big gray area there. Joyce, what else have you got on your list that we should know about?
Well, I think something that we may actually notice fairly soon is part of the big energy utilities bill that was passed. That one of the more controversial parts of this, although there was a lot of controversial parts in it, but one of the most controversial was the energy conservation, energy efficiency program that's been in place in Iowa for a number of years. Currently, anybody who pays your electric or gas bill to a rate-regulated utility, a certain percentage of their bill goes into an energy efficiency fund, mm-hmm. and then that money is used for the programs that many of us are aware of rebates for energy efficiency appliance, home energy audits, reworking of insulation in your house, and all of those things. Well, currently, when you get your bill, a certain percentage of your bill is going to that, but it's not spelled out. And so this is going to, first of all, it's going to give everybody the option to opt out of that, so that will no longer be taken out of their bill. And also it will be spelled out, according to this law, this will be spelled out on your bill. So it will say this certain amount that you're paying is going into this energy efficiency program. And the very strong Republican sentiment on this, that this was we were being taxed without knowing, and this was being charged to us and we didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the energy efficiency advocates are very concerned that once people have the option to opt out, that people will opt out and that fund is going to go way down. There'll be less money for these energy efficiency projects. But I'm going to be looking at my utility bill to see when this shows up there.
Question from Larry in Marion, listening. He wants us to hear about the move over, pull over for flashing light vehicles law. What is that?
Well, I'll jump in on that. Currently, the law actually requires you, as you're driving down the highway, if there's an emergency vehicle parked along the side of the road with flashing lights, then you're required to move over into the left lane if you can, and if you can't, to slow down.
Right. Give at least a lane, if it's permitted, if you have the space, give at least a lane space, right?
Right. And this bill just expands that to other vehicles along the side of the road, mm-hmm. Even if it's private vehicles, if they've got flashing lights, then it's called the new move over rule.
Okay, has a flashing light.
That's right.
What if I put a flashing light on?
Well, if you're in trouble, we recently had a car trouble and we put the emergency lights on. You know, I would rather, I'm parked on the side of the road. I would rather people
hazard
move
lights.
Over.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Not something you have put on the roof of your car. A few minutes left. Yeah.
I wanted to make sure that I highlighted two kind of education-related bills that I thought were interesting. One is just ensuring that school districts have some type of emergency plan in place in case of an active shooter situation. Mm-hmm. It was legislation that had been discussed early in the legislative session, but picked up a lot of steam after the Parkland shooting in February. School districts will have, my understanding is, at least another year before those plans have to be in place, but it is an interesting one to me. And it doesn't specify what those plans have to be, it's just that school districts have to have it in place. And second from that is another one that didn't get a lot of attention, but is just on the subject of virtual schools. Iowa actually allows the use of taxpayer money to go towards these for-profit companies that offer some online learning. And it's primarily worked through two school districts. And it's always had a cap on enrollment. And so this past legislative session, they got rid of the cap. And so I'm really curious to see what the appetite is in the state for this kind of virtual schools.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of appetite, lunch shaming was addressed by a new law, right? This is a situation where I guess a new law says kids can't be publicly shamed or stigmatized if they don't have money to pay for the lunches. This is, I guess, the scenario I've heard. You get to the end of the lunch line, you're long overdue paying for your lunches, and you've picked out a lunch and it goes in the trash, right?
Yes, that's my understanding of what was happening in the state. And I think ultimately the legislation's aimed at ensuring that school districts are communicating more with parents and guardians about it, making sure that they know that if they qualify for free or reduced lunch, that they are able to take advantage of it. But it's a subject that has gotten a lot more national attention in the last few years. Mm-hmm. So I think the state is kind of catching up with that.
Okay. We have just a few seconds left. Any final words, perhaps looking to the future and how any of these issues will be used in the campaign?
Joyce, I don't know if you want to step into that one first, but
just a very few seconds.
I just want to note that I think a lot of the legislation that was passed this year, you can expect it to play a role in the gubernatorial race, issues over abortion and health care. This is going to be really the first test of the 2016 elections in terms of Republican policy. So it'll be interesting to see how voters turn out.
And okay. I think the Sanctuary Cities bill is likely to be on the Republican agenda as they campaign.
Okay. Thank you very much. Joyce Russell, IPR legislative correspondent, Barbara Rodriguez of the Associated Press in Iowa. Barbara, Joyce, thank you very much for this survey of new Iowa laws.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moonhelp. Also today from Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, have a happy holiday and tune in for our noon hour, Capital Steps, Politics Takes a Holiday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.